That is clear.
Inasmuch then, as one thing does not become older or younger than another, in that they always differ from each other by an equal number, the one cannot become older or younger than the others, nor the others than the one, but inasmuch as that which came into being earlier, and that which came into being later must continually differ from each other by a different portion. In this point of view the others must become older and younger than the one, and the one than the others.
Certainly.
For all these reasons, then, the one is, and becomes older and younger than itself and the others, and neither is, nor becomes older or younger than itself or the others.
Certainly.
But since the one partakes of time, and partakes of becoming older and younger, must it not also partake of the past, the present, and the future?
Of course it must.
Then the one was, and is, and will be, and was becoming, and is becoming, and will become.
Certainly.
And there is, and was, and will be something which is in relation to it, and belongs to it.
True.
And since we have at this moment opinion and knowledge and perception of the one, there is opinion and knowledge and perception of it.
Quite right.
Then there is name and expression for it, and it is named and expressed, and everything of this kind which appertains to other things appertains to the one.
Certainly, that is true.
Yet once more, and for the third time, let us consider, if the one is both one and many, as we have described, and is neither one nor many, and participates in time, must it not, in as far as it is one, at times partake of being, and in as far as it is not one, at times not partake of being?
Certainly.
But can it partake of being when not partaking of being, or not partake of being when partaking of being?
Impossible.
Then the one partakes, and does not partake of being at different times, for that is the only way in which it can partake and not partake of the same.
True.
And is there not also a time at which it assumes being, and relinquishes being? For how can it have, and not have the same thing, unless it receives, and also gives it up at some time?
Impossible.
And the assuming of being is what you would call becoming?
I should.
And the relinquishing of being you would call destruction?
I should.
The one then, as would appear, becomes, and is destroyed by taking and giving up being?
Certainly.
And being one and many, and in process of becoming and being destroyed, when it becomes when it ceases to be many, and when many, it ceases to be one.
Certainly.
And as it becomes one and many, must it not inevitably experience separation and aggregation?
Inevitably.
And whenever it becomes like and unlike, it must be assimilated and dissimilated?
Yes.
And when it becomes greater or less or equal, it must grow, or diminish, or be equalized?
True.
And when being in motion it rests, and when being at rest it changes to motion, it can surely be in no time at all.
How can it?
But that a thing which is previously at rest should be afterwards in motion, or previously in motion, and afterwards at rest, without experiencing change, is impossible.
Impossible.
And surely there cannot be a time in which a thing can be at once neither in motion, nor at rest.
There cannot.
But neither can it change without changing.
True.
When then does it change? For it cannot change either when at rest, or when in motion, or when in time.
It cannot.
And does this strange thing in which it is at the time of changing really exist?
What thing?
The moment, for the moment seems to imply something out of which change takes place into either of two states, for the change is not from the state of rest as such, nor from the state of motion as such, but there is this curious nature which we call the moment lying between rest and motion, not being in any time, and into this and out of this what is in motion changes into rest, and what is at rest into motion.
So it appears.
And the one then, since it is at rest, and also in motion, will change to either, for only in this way can it be in both. And, in changing it changes, in a moment, and when it is changing it will be in no time, and will not then be either in motion, or at rest.
It will not.
And it will be in the same case in relation to the other changes. When it passes from being into cessation of being, or from not being into becoming, then it passes between certain states of motion and rest, and neither is not, nor becomes, nor is destroyed.
Very true.
And on the same principle, in the passage from one to many, and from many to one, the one is neither one nor many, neither separated nor aggregated, and in the passage from like to unlike, and from unlike to like, it is neither like nor unlike, neither in a state of assimilation nor of dissimilation, and in the passage from small to great and equal, and back again, it will be neither small nor great, nor equal, nor in a state of increase, or diminution, or equalization.
True.
All these, then, are the affections of the one, if the one has being.
Of course.
But if one is, what will happen to the others? Is not that also to be considered?
Yes.
Let us show then, if one is, what will be the affections of the others than the one?
Let us do so.
Inasmuch as there are things other than the one, the others are not the one. For if they were, they could not be other than the one.
Very true.
Nor are the others altogether without the one, but in a certain way they participate in the one.
In what way?
Because the others are other than the one inasmuch as they have parts. For if they have no parts, they would be simply one.
Right.
And parts, as we affirm, have relation to a whole.
So we say.
And a whole must necessarily be one made up of many, and the parts will be parts of the one. For each of the parts is not a part of many, but of a whole.
How do you mean?
If anything were a part of many, being itself one of them, it will surely be a part of itself, which is impossible, and it will be a part of each one of the other parts, if of all. For if not a part of someone, it will be a part of all the others, but this one, and thus will not be a part of each one, and if not a part of each one, it will not be a part of any one of the many. And not being a part of any one, it cannot be a part or anything else of all those things of none of which it is anything.
Clearly not.
Then the part is not a part of the many, nor of all, but is of a certain single form, which we call a whole, being one perfect unity framed out of all. Of this the part will be a part.
Certainly.
If, then, the others have parts, they will participate in the whole, and in the one.
True.
Then the others than the one must be one perfect whole, having parts.
Certainly.
And the same argument holds of each part, for the part must participate in the one. For if each of the parts is a part, this means, I suppose, that it is one separate from the rest and self-related, otherwise it is not each.
True.
But when we speak of the part participating in the one, it must clearly be other than one. For if not, it would not merely have participated, but would have been one. Whereas only the one itself can be one.
Very true.
Both the whole and the part must participate in the one, for the whole will be one whole, of which the parts will be parts, and each part will be one part of the whole which is the whole of the part.
True.
And will not the things which participate in the one be other than it?
Of course.
And the things which are other than the one will be many, for if the things which are other than the one were neither one, nor more than one, they would be nothing.
True.
But, seeing that the things which participate in the one as a part, and in the one as a whole, are more than one, must not those very things which participate in the one be infinite in number?
How so?
Let us look at the matter thus. Is it not a fact that in partaking of the one they are not one, and do not partake of the one at the very time when they are partaking of it?
Clearly.
They do so then as multitudes in which the one is not present.
Very true.
And if we were to abstract from them an idea of the very smallest fraction, must not that least fraction, if it does not partake of the one, be a multitude, and not one?
It must.
And if we continue to look at the other side of their nature, regard it simply, and in itself, will not be, as far as we see them, be unlimited in number?
Certainly.
And yet, when each several part becomes a part, then the parts have a limit in relation to the whole, and to each other, and the whole in relation to the parts.
Just so.
The result to the others than the one is that the union of themselves and the one appears to create a new element in them which gives to them limitation in relation to one another, whereas in their own nature they have no limit.
That is clear.
Then the others than the one, both as whole and parts, are infinite, and also partake of limit.
Certainly.
Then they are both like, and unlike one another, and themselves.
How is that?
Inasmuch as they are unlimited in their own nature, they are all affected in the same way.
True.
And inasmuch as they all partake of limit, they are all affected in the same way.
Of course.
But inasmuch as their state is both limited and unlimited, they are affected in opposite ways.
Yes.
And opposites are the most unlike of things.
Certainly.
Considered, then, in regard to either one of their affections, they will be like themselves and one another, considered in reference to both of them together, most opposed and most unlike.
That appears to be true.
Then the others are both like and unlike themselves and one another.
True.
And they are the same and also different from one another, and in motion, and at rest, and experience every sort of opposite affection, as may be proved without difficulty of them, since they have been shown to have experienced the affections aforesaid.
True.
Suppose, now, that we leave the further discussion of these matters as evident, and consider again upon the hypothesis, that the one is, whether the opposite of all this is, or is not equally true of the others.
By all means.
Then let us begin again, and ask, if one is, what must be the affections of the others?
Let us ask that question.
Must not the one be distinct from the others, and the others from the one?
Why so?
Why? Because there is nothing else beside them which is distinct from both of them, for the expression one and the others includes all things.
Yes, all things.
Then we cannot suppose that there is anything different from them in which both the one and the others might exist.
There is nothing.
Then the one and the others are never in the same.
True.
Then they are separated from each other.
Yes.
And we surely cannot say that what is truly one has parts.
Impossible.
Then the one will not be in the others, as a whole, nor as part, if it be separated from the others, and has no parts.
Impossible.
Then there is no way in which the others can partake of the one, if they do not partake either in whole, or in part.
It would seem not.
Then there is no way in which the others are one, or have in themselves any unity.
There is not.
Nor are the others many, for if they were many, each part of them would be a part of the whole, but now the others, not partaking in any way of the one, are neither one nor many, nor whole, nor part.
True.
Then the others neither are, nor contain two, or three, if four entirely deprived of the one.
True.
Then the others are neither like, nor unlike the one, nor is likeness and unlikeness in them, for if they were like and unlike, or had in them likeness and unlikeness, they would have two natures in them opposite to one another.
That is clear.
But for that which partakes of nothing to partake of two things was held by us to be impossible.
Impossible.
Then the others are neither like nor unlike, nor both. For if they were like or unlike, they would partake of one of those two natures, which would be one thing, and if they were both, they would partake of opposites, which would be two things, and this has been shown to be impossible.
True.
Therefore they are neither the same, nor other, nor in motion, nor at rest, nor in a state of becoming, nor of being destroyed, nor greater, nor less, nor equal, nor have they experienced anything else of the sort. For, if they are capable of experiencing any such affection, they will participate in one, and two, and three, and art, and even, and in these, as has been proved, they do not participate, seeing that they are all together, and in every way devoid of the one.
Very true.
Therefore if one is, the one is all things, and also nothing, both in relation to itself, and to other things.
Certainly.
Well, and ought we not to consider next what will be the consequence, if the one is not?
Yes, we ought.
What is the meaning of the hypothesis, if the one is not? Is there any difference between this and the hypothesis, if the not one is not?
There is a difference, certainly.
Is there a difference only, or rather are not the two expressions, if the one is not, and if the not one is not, entirely opposed?
They are entirely opposed.
And suppose a person to say, if greatness is not, if smallness is not, or anything of that sort, does he not mean, whenever he uses such an expression, that what is not is other than other things?
To be sure.
And so when he says if one is not, he clearly means that what is not is other than all others. We know what he means, do we not?
Yes, we do.